From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the year 1541 in what is now known as Kansas. A Spanish explorer named Francisco Vázquez de Coronado led an expedition through parts of what is now the southwestern United States. His expedition offered the first European sightings of the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River. And his countrymen established settlements in modern Florida in the following decades. We could go on here. A Spanish mission was established in modern New Mexico in 1598. These historical notes are highlighted in a recent piece by Will Wilkinson for Vox, in which Wilkinson contends that the Americanness of Hispanic Americans ought to be indisputable. In other words, for white nationalists, for nativists who trumpet the white European roots, Wilkinson writes, the current immigration debate really for them has become whether Latinos are real Americans. And he writes that nativists and white nationalists have made significant gains while liberal pluralists are caught off guard. After all, many people thought this whole debate over the value of multiculturalism was over in this country. Wilkinson writes, quote, the standard narrative of American history begins with the establishment of English colonies on the East Coast and then follows the westward expansion of official U.S. territory. This makes it easy to overlook that the mestizo mixture of Spanish and the southwestern indigenous ancestry is older in the United States and that Mexicans inhabited U.S. territory before it became U.S. territory. End quote. This hour, a conversation about immigration policy and whether liberal pluralists have to re-engage certain debates that they might have assumed they had won long ago. My guests include on the line with us Will Wilkinson, the Niskanen Center's Vice President for Policy. Will, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on, Evan.
Also with us in studio is Julio Sáenz, who is the General Manager of Poder 97.1 and a longtime journalist. Julio, welcome back to the program.
Happy to be here, Kevin.
Well, I want to start with you on this. And, you know, there's been a lot written about DACA and the immigration debate. But your writing for the Niskanen Center on the blog there and now for Vox highlights how you think the sort of either the goalposts have moved or in many ways there's been kind of a, I guess, a bait and switch in that during the campaign we heard a lot about a wall. But now the status quo immigration system is being attacked by largely the right. I don't want to just make this bifurcation of right and left, but tell me a little bit more about what you think is going on right now.
Well, Trump was able to kind of sweep into the Republican primaries and take everyone off guard by running really hard to the right of the mainstream Republican Party in terms of immigration and a bunch of issues about national identity. His campaign, in a only slightly veiled way, was what it means to be a real American. The, you know, those red baseball caps, make America great again, right? Like they're saying something about when America was great, and the idea is that America was great when it was whiter, and it makes a lot of sense that he would start his campaign, in Trump Tower, railing against Mexican, rapists and gang members. You know, they're not sending their best people. What he was doing was latching onto the anxiety a lot of mostly non-urban white Americans have about the changing demographics of the American population. In the mid-2040s, the U.S. is set to become a majority-minority country. And that has a lot of people really, really freaked out. So things like build a wall, that is about creating a literal barrier between, real Americans and the people who are making America browner in a way that they find frightening or disconcerting or at least degrading to the status and privilege to which they're accustomed here in the United States.
And now I wanted to make sure we right out of the gate here, we talk about whether some Americans have to re-engage a debate they didn't want to engage. And let me read a comment from a listener named Robert on Twitter who says, we should not be, or at least he didn't want us to engage nativism and white nationalists. He writes, Evan, we know what they want. Bringing them into the conversation just elevates them to legit status. Historically, the painful punishment is to ostracize and banish. They are a virus that needs to be contained. Put them back under a rock. We were doing okay with that until we started giving a lot of attention every time someone like Richard Spencer poked their head up. That's from Robert on Twitter. Will, you make a case in the piece that people like Robert, I think well-intended, are missing the point that there has been much more success in white nationalism in gaining a policy hold, and that it sounds to me like you might disagree. What would you say to someone like Robert who says, we've just got to ignore them?
Well, I really understand and sympathize with the idea that there are certain notions in politics that are kind of over the line, and that addressing them publicly gives them legitimacy, and so that it's better to try to marginalize them, kind of push them off the public stage. And that kind of strategy, that strategy of marginalization and stigma is profoundly important for maintaining a certain kind of civil discourse, kind of maintaining some limits to how we're going to talk to each other. Because if you start talking to each other in racist terms and frankly sexist terms, that suggests that everybody who's participating in public discourse doesn't have equal standing. And we can't stand for that, right? Like, we have to try to enforce our equality and our right to speak up and be heard. But if that has failed, if the strategy, and that's largely what people have in mind when they're talking about political correctness, this kind of strategy of trying to enforce these social norms around the way we're going to talk about politics, about one another. When that's failed, just trying to get the stigma going again tends to be, I think, a sort of futile effort. You have to address in a straight-on way what people are saying. And if that gives their views legitimacy, I don't want to do that. But at the same time, if their views are making a lot of headway, you have to check that headway. And you can't check it by refusing to address it.
Sure. And getting ready for this program, I've had a number of conversations digitally via email and otherwise with people who would identify as white nationalists. I'm trying to understand. And here's the interesting thing. The white nationalists I've been talking to tell me that Will's piece is on the money. Now, they disagree with Will's policy goals. And we're going to get to policy in a moment here, because Will has written significantly about policy for the Niskanen Center, especially recently, about goals and sort of how to make sure that the debate is framed in the right way. But white nationalists don't disagree with the crux of Will's piece. They would like to define certain parts of people, populations, out of what it means to be an American. And they agree with Will there. So let me just read from another post that Will wrote recently for the Niskanen Center. Quote, populist nativists such as Trump and his media champions and outlets like Breitbart and the Daily Caller get a ton of rhetorical and political mileage from railing against the specter of open borders and then constantly narrowing the definition of open to include most every policy that allows the admission of any immigrants, end quote. So, Will, here's the thing. White nationalists tell me that is exactly right. They want, at minimum, zero immigration. If they can't get to deportation tomorrow, they want zero immigration going forward, at the very least. They want it capped. And many conservatives are arguing for these kinds of policies now. But if you ask them whether, I'm not saying all conservatives, by the way, but if you ask people who are in sort of the National Republican Party on the national stage whether they support white nationalism, well, they say, of course not. So, Will, do you think they are unwilling to confront their feelings on their own feelings on white nationalism, or are they unaware they're sort of taking up with white nationalist policy goals?
I think it's mostly the latter. The United States has a two-party system, and that ensures that each of the parties encompasses a huge, diverse array of Americans' views. If we had a parliamentary system that had, proportional representation, you could have these little parties. There'd probably be a, white nationalist party that had, 10, 15% of the population or something like that. It would be a minor party. It would not be the, sort of dominant conservative party. These views have a tendency to blend into one another. And there's this, very, very tense internal debate within the GOP, within the right, about immigration. You'll remember in the primaries in 2016, Trump was running against pretty dovish conservatives on immigration. Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush are really moderate on a lot of immigration issues, and there's this big cleavage within the right, and I would stay far, far, far away from attributing white nationalist or racist sentiments to people who want to slow down immigration a little bit. I think there are completely legitimate sort of intellectual reasons, I may not agree with them, why people would, want to slow down immigration a little bit. There's, an economic rationale for it. There are people have worries about assimilation. People have worries about what happens when populations become too diverse too fast. Does that erode our ability to relate to each other and trust each other? So there's a lot of, I think, perfectly reasonable arguments for slowing down immigration, and that they really have nothing to do with sort of white nationalist sentiments. But white nationalists have a very clever way of kind of jumping back and forth between nativist, xenophobic, very frank arguments about who counts and who doesn't as an American, who gets to be an American, who doesn't, on the one hand, which basically, it doesn't matter if immigrants commit crimes at a lower rate than native-born Americans do, which is true.
Which they do, yeah.
I say this all the time. If you're worried about crime, you just shouldn't be worried about immigrants. In fact, more immigrants in your community is going to reduce the crime rate, right? Like, so that kind of argument is a good argument to give to somebody if they're worried about crime. But if somebody's actually worried about the fact that American national identity to them is white and Christian, and non-white people, non-Christian people in their country, to them just seems like a threat to the nation, you can't address that threat by talking about crime rates. You can't address their sense of threat by talking about whether or not low-skill immigrants reduce wages for native workers. Those kinds of considerations are important, but only if those are what opponents to immigration are actually worried about. And when you talk to relatively frank white nationalist, nativist, xenophobic types, as soon as you identify what they're actually talking about, and try to address it in a direct way, they have a tendency to kind of push you back to one of these issues, economic issues or issues about crime. And that's really just a way of distracting you, right? And those arguments are arguments that do appeal to a lot of conservatives who aren't nativist or xenophobic in any important way. And the way that they jump back and forth is part of the problem in gaining clarity about what's really at stake.
We're talking to Will Wilkinson, the Niskanen Center's vice president for policy, whose recent piece for Vox was called "The Immigration Debate is About Whether Latinos Are Real Americans." And we've posted it on multiple platforms for you to check it out. Also with us in studio, Julio Sáenz, general manager of Poder 97.1. And in studio now with us is Tricia Cruz Irving from the Ibero-American Action League. Tricia, I want to ask both of our guests in studio to kind of weigh in on some of this as well. So, Tricia, I think it's important to point out here, I do want to get away from sort of the false dichotomy of right, left, that sometimes, I'm sure I've done it too, the media kind of gets into the sentiment that, non-white Americans are politically left. There's a diversity, but we are talking about the current policy debate on the national level that is being driven by the current Republican leadership. And I'm wondering how you felt about Will's piece saying that, whether we know it or not here, it's important to engage with the fact that we're talking about whether Latinos are real Americans. Do you think that's a fair point?
Well, I think when I read the piece, I think it's really any time that you try to diminish the value of a human being, it's disturbing. Especially, you know, as I sit here as a Hispanic American myself, to hear that, it's kind of like, wow. You know, I don't take those kinds of things, speaking from a personal level, I don't take those things personally, because when I was little, I had to go through a lot of stuff that now got me to the point where I just don't take that stuff personally, those insults. But certainly I can see why people would take a step back and really be outraged and not like the direction the country is heading in. And that's not that I'm, you know, leaning one way or the other as far as political parties are concerned. It's just, you know, when you hear the kind of talk that you do from, you know, a lot of different people as a Hispanic American, it can be disturbing.
Do you think it's important to reengage this debate, and that Will's point about liberal pluralists who feel like, hey, you know, multiculturalism is something that this country embraces. We won that debate long ago. We can sit on the sidelines here because that's been decided. Will's warning that if you do that, well, you've got sort of a national policy debate where people are making gains and no one's sort of standing up to them. Do you agree with that?
Well, I know, I think you said Robert was his name, that he said, you know, yeah. why don't we just ignore when things like this are being said? I think that's really hard to do because, you know, you can't really ignore that because, if, let's say, for example, you have people like me, you know, I was born in this country. My parents, my mom is from Chile, my dad's from Puerto Rico. So not everyone can just stand back and ignore it. And I don't think that if you say something to me, that's not elevating it even more or giving them, you know, credibility. It's really just speaking up for what you believe in, for the person that you are. I think there are different ways of going about, you know, doing different things to respond. You know, certainly I never think that engaging with somebody, you know, insults. I don't think exchanging insults with somebody, that's the way to go. That's not positive. So for example, if we've got, let's say, somebody who's saying something negative about Hispanics, well, okay, my thinking is, what can we do to show them something positive? You know, and, you know, then call out more people from our community to showcase more of the positive things that we're doing to show, look. And at the end of the day, sometimes you're just not going to change the way some people feel. They're going to feel the way that they do no matter what.
Julio Sainz is general manager of Poder 97.1, but also has many years experience in different markets in this country as a journalist. And I'm curious to know, Julio, what you make of sort of the journalist role in this. I can't tell you how often I hear from listeners who say, you should not have put this person on the air, or you should not have read this email, or you can't engage with XYZ because that, quote, normalizes it. And I hear that all the time. How do you feel about it from a journalistic standpoint?
Well, I think that is a bias that's been put on full display over the last couple of years with the last presidential cycle. And, you know, I also teach communications at RIT, and I spent quite a bit of time last semester on this idea of false balance, where you give people equal time, and we, as journalists, are trained to do that. It's what we are supposed to do. But when you have to dig so hard to find somebody with the other opinion, or you put somebody on equal footing with someone that's either a radical or has a radical view that maybe only a few percentage points of the American public support, I wonder if it's really serving the truth. I think you can give those folks an opportunity to have an opinion, but when you put it on equal footing. And so, you know, it's with a lot of the current things that you see on the news, you know, do you have somebody that is has a PhD in a medical field with somebody that's an anti-vaccination person?
Yeah, sure,
that
yes.
Spent 20 minutes on Facebook
yes,
reading
that's
about
it. That's a failure of journalism. I take that point. But the sort of the extreme opposite is not covering the goals of white nationalism at all.
Well, that's, I think, then this is a very good article, I think, because we have to get to the core of why some people are just anti-immigration and by that way also being anti-Hispanic. And I think that's what this is brings up in this article. It's a great point because you can't convince those people with statistics. I think Will alluded to that just earlier. You can say that, you know, immigration does not raise crime, that these people work really hard. If anyone, and from my experience in other markets, I spent a lot of time working with these communities in Los Angeles and Atlanta, and these folks went through so much suffering and cost and effort to get here. Most of them are deathly afraid of breaking any single crime. I mean, there's all these statistics and facts that show that, look, this is not the way you're characterizing this population is not accurate. But There's a core in the party that is not going to take any of that for any value and still send out this messaging that then filters out through the rest of the party. And so I think by identifying the folks that are at their core ethno-nationalist and sort of calling out what they're trying to propose for our country, we can hopefully root it out and not let it filter out to other people who then get bits and pieces of it and maybe start to believe some of their false information.
All right, so Julio's making, I think, a hugely important but troubling point here, which is that basic data and stats don't tend to work. And I want to ask Will about this because one of his recent blog posts for the Niskanen Center focused on the reality of migration in this country. Because you talk to, whether it's the Trump White House or people who are nativists or white nationalists, they tell you that we are an open borders disaster. That's what they will tell you. Let me read from some of what Will wrote about the numbers, and we'll ask Will if he thinks that's actually impacting people who make some of those claims. Quote, in 2016, 11.4 million people entered the lottery for 50,000 diversity visas. An authentically open borders version of the diversity visa program would admit 100% of those applicants, not less than one half of 1%. The mathematicians among us might note that 50,000 is 11.35 million closer to zero than 11.4 million. The restrictionist tradition of labeling those who favor the almost totally closed immigration policy status quo as open borders advocates is grossly dishonest. Will also quotes the UN's 2015 migration report, saying that between 2000 and 2015, the number of migrants grew in 167 countries or areas worldwide, and in 63 of these, including France, Germany, and the United States of America, the international migrant stock grew by less than 2% per annum. In 104 countries or areas, however, the pace of growth during that period was considerably faster, with 19 countries or areas recording an average annual growth rate of 6% or more. So, in other words, Will writes, it is very easy to say that the U.S. status quo right now is much closer to completely closed than completely open under even the most modest estimates of movement under the completely open counterfactual. Will, does that work with people? I mean, you talk to people. One of the things I've admired about your work for years is, whether it's on Blogging Heads or many other platforms, you like the debate. You like to engage with people who disagree. But do the numbers actually sink in at all with people who are concerned that we are an open borders disaster?
Well, you know, it really, really depends. And that, in you know, my views about a lot of things used to be a lot different. And I think there are you know, different kinds of people. There are really intellectually curious, open-minded people who are interested in arriving at the truth. But what you happen to believe at any given time is a function of your background, how you're educated, who's around you. And so in my experience, I think it's very, very hard to tell whether or not somebody's views are honest or dishonest, whether they're open-minded or closed-minded, whether they're dogmatic or searching. And so I think you have to default. You have to treat people like they're open to learning things, to listening to the evidence and hearing the numbers. I think Julio made a crucial point, and that is incredibly important to the way this debate works. Again, I want to emphasize that the kind of nativist faction of the right is, it's a very small minority. It's a minority of the Republican Party, right? So and the Republican Party has fewer people in it than the Democratic Party. So it's a minority faction of the numerically minority party. The reason we have to talk about it now is that somehow one of its members became president of the United States, and some of those people are running American immigration policy, right? So, and they have now a platform that's incredibly powerful. So people are very, very partisan. If you're a member of if you're a Republican, your views tend to reflect whatever the leadership of your party thinks. You know, it's not that people come up with their opinions about issues first and then find the party that reflects their opinion. That's just, that gets it backwards. Like, what people do is they're like, what social identity do I have that is important to me, that's salient to me? What group membership is you know, definitive to me. And then you go and find the party that members of your group are, you know, members of. And then you believe whatever the party believes. And so my worry right now is that Republicans, most of who don't believe any of this stuff that you hear from, you know, Steve Bannon or Stephen Miller or Trump when he's really being Trumpy, people don't, like, I'm worried that they'll take that on despite the fact that they don't have any drive to believe stuff that's hateful or divisive. People just tend to believe what their party believes. And so I think it is very, very helpful right now to be pushing back against nativist talking points, because right now there are a bunch of people who are not disposed to be nativists who are listening very, very carefully to some nativist people, like the president. And I think a lot of those people are completely open-minded and are totally open to evidence. And if you push back in the right kind of way and say, like, no, you can't accept this framing of closed versus open borders, right? To have some immigration isn't to be open borders. And to show them that, in fact, the United States of America has a quite restrictive immigration policy relative to other wealthy countries, I think that does get through. And it's important to keep hammering on that stuff, because the party leadership is going to change again in the future. And you want those people to stay in the reasonable zone, so that when reasonable Republicans come back into power, this kind of policy approach isn't too sticky.
All right. So, listeners, we've got some phone calls lined up here and plenty of your emails to read. If you want to call the program and weigh in on this, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You hear Will Wilkinson on the line with us, the Niskanen Center's Vice President for Policy in Washington. He's the author of the piece for Vox last week titled "The Immigration Debate is About Whether Latinos Are Real Americans." In studio with us, Julio Saenz, General Manager for Poder 97.1, and Tricia Cruz Irving from the Ibero-American Action League. Let's get that only break of the hour. We'll come back to your emails and phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the NBA is rethinking its policy on high school athletes. For now, high school athletes can't go directly to the pros. They've got to go to college, at least for a year. But after another NCAA scandal of paying athletes, the NBA is getting sick of it. So they're considering a change, and meanwhile, some are calling on the NCAA to finally pay student athletes. Is it time? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we jump to your phone calls and emails, Tricia Cruz Irving has a story she wanted to relate on this subject. Go ahead, Tricia.
So this is something that happened, I think it was back last August, 2017, and I've never forgotten it. I was in my office at iBureau, and the phone rings. And the man on the other end, the first thing he says to me, "Can you tell me why it is that Puerto Ricans have to fly their flag on their car the way that they do?" And I think this was like around the Puerto Rican festival.
Okay.
And, you know, I ended up engaging him for 40 minutes, where I know that probably anybody else in my situation would have hung up on him. But, you know, we proceeded to talk, and he was very clear about his views that, you know, he didn't support immigration. He didn't understand a lot of the things that people from different cultures did. And, you know, but he didn't insult me. He wasn't, you know, rude or anything. He was just stating his views. And I decided to stay on the phone with him for a couple of reasons. Because, one, I knew that anybody else would have hung up on him. And I was like, you know what, at least let me see if we can have a civil conversation. Because at least, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, lately, nowadays, in the last couple of years, for many years now, is when you have a different point of view, sometimes people get very defensive and you can't talk to them. You know, it's nice if we could just get in the room, and if you have a different point of view, that's okay. You know, because we all have different experiences, both personal and professional, that have shaped us into who we are. So I sat on the phone with him for 40 minutes, and he, you know, was expressing his views, and he came out and said, you know, I'm a 60-year-old white man who's retired, probably with too much time on my hands. So we were talking, and I was trying to give him a different point of view from my perspective. And I will tell you that by the end of that conversation, he said to me, and I had asked him at one point, I was like, "Would you say that you're racist?" And he's like, "You know, that's a really good question." And he said, "Probably." But at the end of that conversation, he says to me, you know what, Ms. Cruz? He's like, you've given me a lot to think about. Would it be okay if I called you from time to time just to pick your brain about things that I just don't understand? And to me, that was amazing, because here you have somebody who was very clear and set in his ways, did not support immigration, didn't like the idea of other people being here from different countries, different ethnic backgrounds. But I engaged him in a conversation, and at the very end, he could have just been like, no, I don't agree with you. I don't like you. You shouldn't be here either. But no, at the end, what he did was, thank you for giving me some things to think about. Is it okay if I call you back every so often? And he did. And every once in a while, he's called me just to ask me my opinion on something. And then one time, he even called me because something happened in the news where somebody, a Hispanic American, was being recognized for doing something good with the U.S. military. I don't remember the specifics. And he called to share that story with me because he thought that was something nice that was happening.
Yeah. See, we are in the age of the whole, well, if you support building a wall, then unfriend me on Facebook, because I don't want to. And I just don't know what we profit off that. Mm-hmm. Do we want to just be sort of shouting into a perfect echo chamber, or do we want to have those moments? So I admire you for that. And I would hope that maybe there will be more phone calls like that. And mm-hmm. there will be more change like that. And I think that does hit at the heart of what Will is sort of urging us in the piece to remember that these debates, you know, we don't have this monolithic embrace of multiculturalism. And there have been some advances on this issue. So let me grab our first phone call. Tony in Geneseo. Go ahead, Tony.
Hi. You know, there are a lot of Republicans like Ben Sasse and Jeff Flake, who are definitely pro-immigration and recognize that we need more immigration, not less, for economic development. But I would like to know if your guests have read the National Academy of Science report on the economic and fiscal consequences of immigration, because it's quite interesting. It indicates, you know, that first-generation immigrants are slightly more costly to the economy, but that second-generation immigrants are much better for the economy as opposed to native-born or comparison to native-born people, and that it's clear, at least from that report, that immigration is a very positive net economic gain. I mean, you know, today we have 2.8 workers for every person on Social Security, and if we don't have immigration, that's going to go down to 2.3 in about 25 years. So we need it. But, you know, the facts aren't so clear, and there is economic impact, especially for low-skilled workers in regard to immigration. And I think that should be recognized, just like your guest just said. When you engage people in conversation and recognize what they're trying to say, then you can go on and maybe convince them of a better argument or the real argument. So thanks a lot.
Tony, thanks for the phone call. Julio Sáenz, thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that, you know, and what I was alluding to earlier, when I was talking, there's a core group of people that I think you can't convince with statistics, because it's a much deeper logic that they have, a reasoning, and you could just flat out call racist. That's why they have a problem with immigrants, Hispanic immigrants. But then there's a lot of folks that just don't have their facts straight, that just haven't had exposure to people, that maybe have misunderstanding. They've heard the lies from other people. I remember being at City Grill a few months ago, and I overheard a group of white gentlemen talking, and they were saying that, well, you know, the reason the Democrats want to let immigrants in is because then they'll vote for them. And other times I'll hear, well, people want to come here and just get free benefits. All these misconceptions that are just floating out there that I think you can cure with dialogue and statistics and numbers. There's a lot of reasonable people on both sides.
Okay. Will, thoughts on the caller's comments there?
Well, I agree with them. Immigrants have a extremely positive effect on the economy. And one of the things that's just stressing to nativists and xenophobes who are worried about the changing demographics of the American population, you know, part of that is driven by immigration. Part of it's driven by differential birth rates. So the American white population is birth rates have declined such that in absolute numbers, the white population of the United States is projected to fall because whites are having less than two kids per couple. The contraction of the population is creates a huge problem economically, as the caller suggested. It's a big problem for your big entitlement programs. How are you going to pay for so many retirees in a, you know, a very quickly aging country? So one of the benefits of immigration, in addition to just adding to the population through immigration, is that immigrant populations tend to have higher birth rates, and a higher rate of population growth has a very, 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 very positive economic benefit for everyone. For the people who are worried about letting these people in, they're going to be better off because the economy is going to be stronger. But as long as people are thinking of their interests solely in terms of the relative status of their ethnic group, it's really hard to get through to them on, you know, using evidence like that.
Well, here's an email from a listener named Don who identifies himself as a white nationalist. He says, Evan, I completely agree with Will when he writes this, quote, "We need to square up to the fight at hand. We are having a fight about national identity and about what it means to be an American, about who counts as one of us, and about who should receive full and equal protection under the law." End quote. Don writes, Evan, I know there are many of those on my side, white nationalists, that don't want the equal protection under the law that Will mentions at the end, but I'm not one of them. I guess what I'd want to know from Will is this. What is it that is supposed to hold America together as a nation? Why should we remain one country instead of two or 10 or 50? Will Wilkinson?
Why should we remain one country? Well, if we don't remain one country, that means you have to split. And splitting is violent and divisive and creates huge harms. I think the implication of the question, the presupposition of the question, is that you need some kind of ethnic or cultural homogeneity to bind a population together, that we won't have any reason to see each other as equals if somehow we're too different, that we won't have any reason to see ourselves as having special duties to our fellow citizens if they don't share our skin color or don't share our ethnic or cultural background. And I just think there's almost no reason to believe that, the United States has become much more diverse over the past 30 years and has, during that time, you know, crime has plummeted. Life expectancy continues to go up. The economy continues to grow. So as our country has become, you know, more and more diverse, things have gotten better along a lot of dimensions. And the dimensions along which they've gotten worse simply aren't attributable to immigration or the diversification of the population. If you want to look at like a particular place, like you just go to medium-sized cities and see which ones are failing and which ones are succeeding. And the ones that are failing are the ones that are contracting in their population that are very homogeneously white. And the ones that are succeeding are the ones that are growing, and they're growing in part because of immigration. And so that diversity that breathes new life and revitalizes cities and the country as a whole. And so I just don't think there's really a good reason to think that you need a single thing, a sense of national identity like we've had, that's centered in whiteness, that's centered in Christianity, to bind us together. Because we have some of the best places in the United States are already minority-majority places, and are some of the most successful, wealthy, happy, healthy places in the country.
Don follows up, and I'm going to have Tricia and Julio jump on this first, and we'll turn back to Will as well. He says, Evan, I often hear people say, quote, "We welcome everyone who wants to come." And by the way, Don, before I even continue with your email, I think Will's piece for the Niskanen Center recently indicated that there is a bit of a fallacy here to just believing this idea that we're this open borders and that there is no sort of working infrastructure and system on there. But regardless, he writes, "Population projections say Africa will have 4 billion people by the end of the century. Welcoming everyone who wants to come here for a better life is just not reasonable and would mean the end of America as we know it. Would we draw the line before that? Where and why? Do we have a justification for saying enough? If so, then we all draw lines and we're just arguing about when to draw it. So Trish Cruz Irving, if that was your next phone call at the Ibero-American Action League, and Don is saying, don't we have to have a justification for saying enough to immigration at some point? What do you say?
Well, my initial response is, if people are coming here, you know, following the rules, you know, doing all the paperwork that they're supposed to do and getting the visas that they're supposed to get, then okay, I don't see a problem with that. You know, again, that goes to the fundamental difference of the way people think. So, again, you know, if people are doing it the correct way and following the law, well, then, in my opinion, why stop it? You know, I embrace diversity. I love seeing people from different cultures. I think it's a beautiful thing, you know. So, and then when you have someone who just really feels that the national identity of the country is being threatened, that just goes to a complete, you know, there's just different way, a fundamental way of thinking that's just completely different. And I don't know if you're going to change somebody like that.
Hmm. Julio.
Well, I agree that you have to have a structure to people entering in a country, any country. So no one's suggesting that that doesn't happen. And
that there be no immigration. It's just open borders. Actually, right. There are some. There's a small group of anarchists who do think no borders anywhere.
Sure.
And maybe that's a conversation for another day. But for the most part, it sounds like you think we're attacking straw men in that way.
Right. And yeah, there are some libertarians as well that think that. But for the most part, we do want structure. It's just the fact that you can't argue with the fact that if you do think America is the greatest country on earth, which I do think so, what has made it that is the constant flux of and immigration from people from all over the world that want to come here, that go through the effort and the trouble and the get over all the obstacles to get here, and they bring that energy here.
Yeah, and by the way, I didn't use anarchists as just sort of an out-of-the-air pejorative. I mean, people like Dan Errol and others who really espouse anarchism don't want any borders. But for the most part, Will Wilkinson, you know, you've written about this idea that if we're going to talk about policy, you know, we can't let people move the frame of the debate, but we don't just have to pretend that open borders is a goal here, that there are other ways of sort of putting this debate together. So how do you do that? What is an ideal policy goal as you see it?
Well, I think, so one thing that I think a lot about that I think there's just way too little work on is what the rate of cultural change can be. Like, how fast can a culture change? How fast can you change demographically? How fast can you change in your, you know, social norms before you drive some kind of toxic political blowback? So I call that kind of like the speed limit on social change. And I don't think we know what that is. In systems like ours, a big liberal democratic welfare state, there's a constant tension between openness, immigration, and the sort of generosity of the welfare and social insurance state. And those things are always in tension, which is why the places, you know, like you know, Sweden or Denmark tend to be pretty inclusive. They have pretty open immigration policies, but they're, like ours, mostly closed, because it's hard to sustain that kind of political economy. You have to have insider outsider distinctions to determine who gets these benefits. Right? And so in that sense, citizenship is kind of like a club, and being eligible for government benefits is, you know, one of the perks of membership. And as long as you have that structure, that puts a pretty hard constraint on how much immigration the system is going to allow. So for me, my position is, like, I always want more. I do think people have a presumptive right to travel, have a presumptive right to associate freely with others. And that means that insofar as possible, people should be able to cross borders and work in other jurisdictions. But of course, those jurisdictions are going to govern themselves. And the way they govern themselves is going to put constraints on how many people they're going to let in. And so within that kind of system, I always advocate for letting in as many people as is consistent with the system that we have working as well as it possibly can. And that's still a long, long way from anything like open borders. So my position is just more. And then if you get to more, ask for more again and see if there's any problems. And if there are no problems, ask for more again and see if there's any problems. And if there are no problems, you know, and then you just keep doing it. But if problems start to show up and the system is having a hard time absorbing that level of immigration, then it makes a lot of sense to slow it down. But I don't think we're anywhere near that frontier.
Sarah and Avon next on the phone. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me. I just wanted to highlight our local context a little bit on your show.
Okay.
I want to talk about working at the local level and the local situation. I see our area as having a long history of being under attack because of our proximity to the northern border. So Rochester and the area around it sits within the 100 mile border zone, and we have Border Patrol on our bus systems, on our local bus systems in Rochester, racially profiling riders and asking people about their immigration status. A couple of weeks ago, there was a 60-year-old couple that was picked up, and they've been kind of languishing in the federal detention center in Buffalo since then. I don't know, our economy is incredibly dependent on local immigrant farm workers. We're surrounded by these 24-hour milking parlors with hundreds of immigrant dairy workers living in substandard housing and completely isolated without ability to leave the farms because they don't have access to driver's licenses. So there's this very serious local context that I wish we were talking about. And then there's also a lot of local organizing happening around it to support immigrant farm workers and their families. There's a grassroots organization called Greenlight New York, which is working for a campaign to win access to limited purpose driver's license for undocumented New Yorkers. And that's about, I think it's 850,000 people in New York State are undocumented. And then there's also allied groups like the Rochester Rapid Response Network, which has been set up to support families who are going through detention and deportation. And there's lots of ways that people can plug into this work. So I just wanted to call about that.
Sarah, thank you for the phone call. Julio Sines, do you think the media in this part of our country, we've seen incidents like what she describes with ICE and otherwise. Are we covering that enough and effectively?
I don't think so. I think we just assume that those are things that are happening in the Southwest and the Western United States and not in the Rochester area, which, as we know, is very tied to agriculture for its economy and is dependent on these types of workers.
Yeah. Tricia, what do you think?
Like Julio said, you know, you hear what Sarah said from Avon and to think it's happening, you know, right next door when, you know, you expect it to be happening in different parts of the country, not necessarily right next door.
All right, down to about our last 90 seconds. Will, I've got a couple of emails from listeners who pointed me to a recent piece from the writer Megan McArdle, who is now, among other things, with the Washington Post. She described a trip to Denmark in which her piece, it's worth reading in its entirety, and I'm probably not going to do it justice in summing it up, but she does say that the title of the piece, You Can't Take the Danes Out of Denmark, and she writes that this culture that is not monolithic, but is it's not all that diverse compared to others, has a lot higher level of trust. And a lot of white nationalists took that. Now, Megan jumped on Twitter to say, look, I'm not espousing at all white nationalism. She thinks we can rise above it. But she's saying that because of a lot of that similarity, it breeds trust. Is there any argument there for white nationalists against your piece and in favor of hers there?
No. These measures of trust, we're working on a series of papers on these questions about diversity and social trust at the Niskanen Center. And you do see a correlation between homogeneity and trust. And that's obvious, why that would be the case. And you're more likely to trust people who you're familiar with, you're comfortable with. But if you look kind of beyond this in a superficial way, you don't actually see any negative relationship between diversity and different kinds of trust, the kinds that matter to how well your society goes. What really erodes trust and sometimes what this gets muddled up in this evidence, is that segregation is completely toxic to groups of people trusting each other. And segregation is usually enforced in a country because there is some pre-existing racial animus. So the segregation will tend to reflect a some enmity or animosity. And a lot of times, places that are a little bit more diverse are post-colonial countries that have fairly large minority populations, so they show up as being more diverse. But then they're also highly segregated, which reduces their social trust. So places that are diverse and integrated do just as well as places that are homogenated.
Will's piece is for Vox is called "The Immigration Debate is About Whether Latinos Are Real Americans." Worth reading, a lot of good historical context there. And Will Wilkinson from the Niskanen Center is the vice president for policy there. Thanks for taking the time, Will. We really appreciate it on this program here.
It's great to be here.
Julio Sáenz, general manager of Poder 97.1. Thank you, as always. Always great to have you, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
And Tricia Cruz Irving, making time for us from the Ibero-American Action League. I know you're busy. We got some great emails, which I'm going to share with you off-air, Tricia, kind of follow-up to your story on the phone call. Let's keep that dialogue going. Thank you for being here,
as always.
Short break, more connections coming up.